free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net. See our past speakers and archive links to those shows as well as upcoming shows. Today is November 26, 2007. We have as our guest Tom Beck of Scheck Labs. He is the CEO and president as well as the inventor of the process. They've been going at it for several years. We'll learn out in a second, or find out in a second, how long exactly. I have to tell you, I've had some personal exposure to this technology. I drove down to Phoenix, Arizona, took a day down and a day back to see this technology about 4 years ago when they were demonstrating at a utility company their technology. That it's a solar hydrogen technology as well as other applications. Today in particular, we're going to be talking about the company's process for they're in process of installing their first commercial facility in Regina, Saskatoon, Canada, that will take the methane from landfills and convert it into hydrogen using solar power, eliminating the methane from going into pollution and produce a viable fuel. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, you've got quite a few things going, but tell us about this system. Maybe, you know, two things I'd like to have you describe for us. I understand some of this is proprietary technology. You don't need to go into anything, of course, that is things you can't talk about. But we'd like to know, our audience generally likes to know how things work. And so let us, fill us in on this process, how you can use solar energy to produce hydrogen, both from water as well as from methane.
Sure. When we started the company a decade ago, and it's going to be our anniversary here pretty quick, December 16th, 1996 is when we incorporated. So we're going to be 10 years old in a short span here, 11 years old. When we formed the company, we thought, how can we economically produce an alternative energy source that's going to be competitive with fossil fuel-based energy? And we kind of analyzed wind power, we kind of analyzed solar power, and at the time, these were relatively expensive technologies compared to fossil fuels. And what we thought was, if we could harness the heat energy of the sun to run a process to produce hydrogen, which was our objective, that could be potentially a very economical means of doing that. So that kind of set our course, our development course, to a thermochemical-based approach. Reason being, the potential efficiencies could be very high, which lends itself to being more economically viable if you can produce at a high conversion efficiency. So what we've done is we've developed some complementary technologies to do this. The first thing we had to do is to develop a process that would thermochemically transform water or methane or water and methane into hydrogen. And we've developed catalyst technologies, which basically are used to accelerate chemical reactions. And we've also developed very special solar reactor technologies to efficiently harness concentrated sunlight to run the process. So one of our key technologies is the solar reactor technology, or the solar thermochemical conversion device. What happens is we have water and methane that enters the device, and we go through a catalytic reaction, a two-step process, catalytic reaction process, where we take waste gases like methane and carbon dioxide from a a biosource such as landfills or any kind of biosource where you're getting anaerobic decay, where you're typically getting carbon dioxide and methane emissions. And what we do in the first catalytic step is we convert this into hydrogen and carbon monoxide. And these are called synthesis gases. What we then do is we go to the second step of the process where we have another catalyst, and we take the carbon monoxide that we created and we react that with water to produce additional hydrogen and carbon dioxide. So we're having carbon dioxide and hydrogen coming out of the process. The hydrogen comes from both the methane and the water, and we have carbon dioxide coming out as well. It should be noted, however, that because the process is using biomatter as the inputs, that the entire process cycle is carbon dioxide neutral. And the reason why is the biomatter that went into the landfill was originally living organic matter that sequestered carbon dioxide from the atmosphere when it was growing. So when you look at the entire energy cycle, it's kind of like the human-plant cycle. We have a symbiotic relationship where we exhale carbon dioxide to plants, use it to produce oxygen. So in this case, we're basically taking the decayed plant material and putting that carbon dioxide back that it had originally sequestered from the atmosphere. So we're producing hydrogen in a carbon dioxide neutral process. Now,
so when you talk about the methane that's coming off the landfill, for example, is primarily coming from organic or plant matter?
That's correct. You're going to have grass clippings, you're going to have kitchen waste, things like this that will deteriorate and degrade within the landfill. And what happens, there's an interesting thing that happens here. When you have this biomaterial degrade, basically in the absence of oxygen, it's called anaerobic decay. And that's where you get your methane emissions from. So what happens normally in a landfill, as an example, these methane emissions will leach through the topsoil and into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And the bad thing about this is methane is 21 times more dangerous as a greenhouse gas compared to carbon dioxide. So it's a very important thing to capture and destroy. In our case, we're destroying it by converting it into hydrogen.
Right. Now, did you earlier say that you could also use carbon dioxide on the input side?
Yes, we do. Mind you, we get carbon dioxide on the output as well, so it kind of goes through the process. Carbon dioxide is part of the process loop. So if we didn't have a carbon dioxide source and you were, say, using natural gas, we would have a carbon dioxide loop as part of the process where we would recycle the carbon dioxide within the system.
And so water is then used as part of the chemical process in the intermediate step where you take hydrogen and carbon monoxide, add water to get hydrogen and carbon dioxide.
That's right.
So could it be said that the primary chemical process it starts with methane as the primary reactant?
Yes, it does. It is a primary reactant, but we still do need the carbon dioxide component.
So carbon dioxide is an important part in that first step, methane plus carbon dioxide.
That's correct.
Catalyzed to hydrogen and carbon monoxide, catalyzed in the presence of water to hydrogen and carbon dioxide.
Yes.
Okay.
The other part of the technology that's complementary to this is the collection array, which is basically a large mirror that focuses the sunlight onto the target. Now, there's technology like that exists for other applications in the world, but we have some very unique characteristics with our technology, and one being is we have a very high point focus ratio where we amplify the sunlight between 5,000 suns and 16,000 suns. And what happens here at the focal point, the temperature is approximately the surface temperature of the sun, which is about 6,000 degrees Celsius and 11,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So why do we do that? We don't actually need that kind of heat to run the process, but we get a significant energy boost by having a very highly focused beam. When you look at solar systems that are concentrating based, you have an energy loss, which is called the emissivity loss. And to explain that a little bit, if you have an object that has a certain temperature to it, it will emit heat energy.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens, as you increase the temperature of that object, the rate of the emission increases greatly to the power of 4. So if you have something at a given temperature and double its temperature, the amount of radiant energy loss goes up by 16 times. It's very significant.
Okay.
So in a point-focused system where you have, say, 700 suns, which is typical of what might be out there in the market today, you have a large target spot size, and you could end up losing about 40% of your energy in just the emissivity or the radiation loss off the system. And of the energy coming in, 40% of the energy is re-radiated out, so it's very, very significant. With our system, we're able to reduce the focal point to a very small size and, of course, a very, very high energy density. But what happens is our target size being much smaller results in a much smaller emissivity loss of only about 5% compared to 40%. So it has created a lot of problems in the development phase to how do you handle that kind of focus, keeping it on track, how do you take that kind of intense solar flux without deteriorating or destroying your target. Those were serious design issues that we faced, and we have resolved those in the system that you had seen in Arizona. So we basically invented the technology that would do both the very high ratio concentration, the advanced tracking, the reception of that energy without destruction or deterioration. And we actually ran trials for a couple of years. We took the system apart to find out what was wearing out, and to our to our satisfaction, I would have to say that we had really no deterioration on the thermochemical reactor at all. It was in pristine condition.
How long did you run it for before you tested for deterioration?
We've had about 2 years of field trials that was going on before we did a dismantling. The only issues we had were very, very minor. We had weather exposure issues where the rain would eventually rust some of our shutter bearings, which is a minor issue. We simply replaced those with stainless steel. And the only other minor issue we had was the UV deterioration of our rubber cooling lines. And again, it was just a minor materials issue. The key technology worked flawlessly, which was really pleasing to us.
So these ancillary problems, can they be repaired with better materials or just with maintenance?
Well, actually, better materials. So, for example, in the shutter system now, we're going to be using stainless steel bearings instead of steel. So that resolves the problem with oxidation of the metal or rusting. And for the cooling hoses, we use a UV-resistant material that can withstand solar radiation for a prolonged period of time. And again, eventually you might replace those cooling hoses, but again, it's a minor maintenance issue.
Mm-hmm. Now, the reason that I had you come on this show was because of a press release that I came across about 2 weeks ago that was saying that the first phase of the Regina facility has come on into place, where you have methane collection now in place on a landfill, and that is presently being gassed off, being burned off. Step two would then be to hook that methane into your system, where it could then be converted to hydrogen using sun energy. How long are you before that's going to be set up, and where are you in that process?
Right now, the gas collection system is installed. There's 27 wells that are going into Regina landfill. And the gas, as you mentioned, is being sucked off and flared. What we've recently done is we've done an acquisition on land next to the landfill, and we're in the process of doing the subdivision. Upon that being complete, which is anticipated about mid-March, we will be starting construction of the facility. And there's going to be two facilities. There's going to be a compressor station on the landfill, which will take the landfill gas and divert it from the flare and pump it about maybe three-quarters of a mile to the processing station, where we will then process the gas. And what we're going to be doing is basically removing contaminants from the landfill gas. There could be sulfates, there could be trace elements of mercury or other contaminants. So we basically remove all the contaminants until we have a relatively pure carbon dioxide methane flow. What we then do is we proportion the carbon dioxide methane to a 50-50 ratio for the processing into hydrogen. So what will happen, we're going to be start deploying the solar arrays that contain the solar reactors that do this one at a time. We're going to start with one, get it deployed. Since it's an upscale, we're going to be testing it, making sure there's no engineering problems or design problems. And if there are, we correct them and then go forward and start deploying more arrays. So we're going to be doing five arrays as the initial deployment. And we anticipate that we possibly could have that done by the end of 2008, the first five arrays. It may go into 2009. And pending the availability of landfill gas, we could be expanding that to 10 more arrays. And pending the further expansion of the gas collection system at the landfill, that potentially could be built out to an additional 20 arrays after that. So what will happen here is we're going to be basically taking the gas, purifying it, removing the contaminants, running it through the process to make hydrogen and carbon dioxide. We capture both, of course, the hydrogen we, of course, capture, and the carbon dioxide we're capturing as well, because there is an aftermarket for carbon dioxide. And what we're going to do is purify the carbon dioxide to food grade and sell that into the food processing market. And we also then purify the hydrogen to the requirement of what a customer might want. So, for example, if the hydrogen was going to be used for a fuel cell application, we would need a very high purity. If it was used for semiconductor processing, again, a very high purity. If it was used for food processing, you wouldn't need quite that high purity. If it was used for a fuel for internal combustion, you don't need a very high purity at all. So the amount of purification will depend on the end use of that hydrogen.
And that purification is going to happen after the process, not going into it, right?
Well, we do the purification in terms of removing the contaminants from the landfill gas. And then, of course, you then do the purification after to get the purity requirement of the hydrogen you need. So there's two steps. There's two purification steps.
Okay. Let's talk for a second about that process, because that sounds like, I'm curious how you would do that. You've got these gases coming off the landfill. Who knows what's going to be coming off of there? And you then have to remove contaminants. How does one go about doing that in an fairly economical way?
You basically use filters and absorbents. So you may have an absorbent that will absorb sulfur or heavy metals, or filters that will basically remove the contaminants. So it's a fairly straightforward process. On the output side, we end up using pressure swing absorption, which is a known science for basically purifying the hydrogen, which is very easy to do for hydrogen purification.
So these are both known and tried and true processes that you're not going to be pioneering along with the other things?
That's correct.
So the only pioneering, well, basically you've done all the pioneering already. It's just a matter of putting these pieces together in this unique way.
Yes, it is. Basically, we've taken the technology we've developed. We're matching it with other technologies in a complete system that are already developed to produce a complete solution.
Well, let's talk for a second about price. How much is your hydrogen gas, for example, going to cost compared to from steam reformation or other processes that exist right now, electrolysis?
Yeah, well, this is interesting because we're looking at a number of things here. One is when you're looking at steam reformation of methane or natural gas, you're looking at having to add energy to the process, and what they do is they will burn off a certain amount of that natural gas, as an example, to run their process to produce hydrogen. It has been the cheapest means for producing hydrogen to date. It doesn't require much for infrastructure compared to what we have to do, because we have a relatively large capital cost, because we have to deploy the array structures, the solar arrays and the solar reactors. So there's higher capital cost for what we need, but the input costs are very low because we're using solar energy as our primary energy source to run the station, which is free other than the capital cost to build it. We're using waste methane and carbon dioxide from a waste source, which is much cheaper than what you would have to pay for using natural gas, for example. So when you compare apples to oranges here, the difference is you have to amortize the station over a number of years in making the comparison, because we do have a high CapEx cost but a low production cost.
Right. And at what point do you become competitive? After how many years do you start surpassing the competition?
The payback on a station will depend, I guess, on the scale of the station. A smaller scale station is going to cost more per unit of energy produced, which is normal.
Mm-hmm.
And in typical steam reformation systems, you wouldn't even go as small a scale as what we're going to be doing on our first project here, because it wouldn't be economically viable. The payback we anticipate to be under 7 years on the first station. And, of course, our first station is going to be the most expensive because it is our first station and there's ramp-up costs associated with that. And we do have a technology plan to implement cost reductions as we're going forward, and that's normal with any new technology. For example, when you bought your first VCR 10 years ago, it cost $2,000. Now you can buy it today for $200.
Mm-hmm.
So similar idea here. We're going to be reducing our costs over time, where we think we're going to get a payback of less than 3 years. And for a renewable energy project, or even an energy project, per se, that's very, very good.
Just on a tangent, we just barely got a DVD and VCR player for $89.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually amazing how cheap they can make that.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's par for the course. Any technology, as it advances, it becomes better and more economical over time, as a general rule.
Right. So let's talk now about rollout in terms of this is your first facility, and you've talked about, you know, the time frame milestones for implementing this, and you're looking at about a 7-year payback on this first one, which, of course, is the most expensive one. Once you start replicating this and franchising it, so to speak, what kind of return on investment are you looking at, and what kind of price point are you looking at for the product? After, let's say, you go down to a 2-year payback, are you looking at being able to cut your price by a third, a half, a three-quarters, what?
Well, I guess our strategy is, because we're a corporation and we require capital to operate and to innovate, which is normal for any company that's not government-funded, then you basically have to have a profit to grow and to maintain your market and to innovate and reduce your costs. So I guess, you know, what we're thinking here is we're going to be going after higher valued markets initially. For example, not the transportation fuel market initially, although that we think will develop pretty quick. The reason being is we're competing with relatively inexpensive fossil fuels, but those prices are going up in terms of, you know, gasoline prices in North America. So we're thinking of industrial markets where customers pay a premium to get their hydrogen. It's referred to as the merchant market, where a customer has delivered their hydrogen from a supplier. So we intend to be competitively priced with that market. And what could factor in here are also green credits that we could obtain because we're producing the hydrogen cleanly and reducing basically carbon dioxide equivalent emissions that would go into the atmosphere. So we're thinking we don't really have to cut our price. We can just have to be competitive with what's going on out there. And in terms of the developing market for motor transportation, this is kind of a dream market that we're thinking of down the road, and not that far down the road. Basically, we have a lot of car manufacturers that are developing fuel cell vehicles or internal combustion engine hydrogen vehicles. BMW currently has a production vehicle that uses hydrogen based on an internal combustion engine, and it'll use either gasoline or hydrogen, and it'll transition from one fuel to the other seamlessly as you're driving. So the vehicles are coming, and we want to be positioned to be able to provide to that market. Even though it's a lower-valued market today, we believe that the price of oil and gas is going to continue to trend upwards as time goes on. In Europe, for example, they're almost double the price of what we are here in North America. I was just talking to a fellow in Europe today, and he says, yeah, the prices up here are just about double what you have in Canada, which is, you know, not surprising considering that's been the trend for how many years there. So we're thinking that in terms of transitioning into the automobile fuel market, that Europe will be a primary market because of the cost advantage we get on the fuel. But we still want to build capacity in North America because even though it's not as profitable, it's going to be essential to have that infrastructure and capacity in place, start offsetting fossil fuel consumption. And, of course, there's an infrastructure buildup that's required to go with that, too. And that's something that will happen. It happened with the gasoline when we were using horse and buggies 100 years ago or whatever. We had a car that was invented, and the infrastructure followed to fuel that car. And we think the same will happen for hydrogen. You know, we see today in fueling stations that will have gasoline, diesel, propane. The next addition can be hydrogen.
Yeah, one of the members of the New Energy Congress is Ty Robinson, and I've driven around with him a little bit. He's got a car that runs on hydrogen and natural gas. He can switch back and forth. And I filled up with him before, and he's got a list of the different stations in Utah and around the country. And even now, the infrastructure is, you know, almost enough in place that you can drive just about anywhere in the country, and, you know, you can drive on hydrogen. It's not quite there yet, but it is coming into place already.
Yeah. So that's something that's a natural migration, and, you know, we're looking forward to seeing that happen on a large scale.
Uh-huh. So do you essentially see your technology as being the leader of the pack for converting methane from whatever source, whether it's landfill or other, into hydrogen economically so that the bottom line, including all costs, capital, and running, et cetera, are less?
I would say we are a leader in respect to providing a renewable hydrogen on that basis.
Uh-huh.
Cost competitive-wise, we're going to get there after Plant 1, I would say,
mm-hmm.
because Plant 1 is more expensive, as would be the case for any kind of deployment, first deployment. We're still getting 95% of our hydrogen today from the steam reformation of fossil fuels. So that's how the large majority of hydrogen is made today. A lot of the cheap natural gas is offshore, not in North America. So, you know, we're seeing production. I think it's Trinidad, for example, where natural gas is relatively cheap. So, you know, you have to go offshore, though, again, to get your energy reliance. And, you know, it'd be good to have that based on a continental basis where you create your energy on the continent. That gives you your best energy security.
Have
and, of course, doing it renewably,
it
just makes sense for society, you know, if we can renewably generate. And, of course, being cost competitive is an essential part of that. And I would like to say that, yes, we will be cost competitive going forward.
I'm wondering also in terms of, let's look 25, 50 years down the road, once you start reaching market penetration, there are only so many landfills. We only produce so much waste per human per day, more so in the Western world than in the developing world. But how much of the energy portfolio could this process account for in an optimized situation where every landfill is equipped to harness or gather the methane that's coming off of it, and that methane is then being converted to hydrogen through this solar process that you've developed? Let's say that you reach 90% market penetration. How much of the transportation industry's fuel would that provide?
That's a good question. I've not done that analysis, so I can't give you an answer off the top of my head. But that's a very good question in another aspect, too, because there's going to be a limit to how much you can provide via that means.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, we are looking at expanding the process beyond landfills. For example, we can use any waste methane source, such as wastewater treatment plants, agricultural operations, waste, forest, biomaterials. So there's a lot of biomaterial that can be used well beyond what we're looking at in landfills. And if we looked at the entire bio picture, I can't say for sure how much of the total energy it could supply, but I think it would be probably tens of percents of the energy requirement that we're looking at. And again, I'd have to verify that. I'm just giving you my best estimate. You know, it might be 10 to 30%. I don't know, just a best guesstimate here.
Right. What are you doing in terms of international rollout? Are you starting to entertain licensure for other countries?
Yes, we are. We're actually looking at a similar project that we want to do in the United States, and we're working with consortium of interested parties in the southern states to deploy a similar station to what we're doing in Regina. And that could be the launching ground for deployment in the states. We're also working in Europe on a number of identified projects where we're looking at basically waste methane sources from landfills, wastewater, agricultural operations. And the markets could be both for fuel for transportation as well as industrial markets for the hydrogen. So we're rolling out, I would say, slowly right now, which is fine because we're still having to deploy Plant 1. But I would see us, accelerating that deployment rate very rapidly once we have at least one plant under our belt.
Okay. We were talking about the components of this earlier, and I'm just wondering, you didn't give us the name or element involved in the catalytic process. Are there any exotic materials involved in this process that might create a bottleneck or a limiting factor in a wide-scale rollout?
I am pleased to say that we don't have to rely on expensive platinum-based catalyst materials. We've developed the catalyst ourselves. It's environmentally safe, so for disposal purposes, if we don't recycle it, it doesn't harm the environment. And there's no serious limitation to obtaining the materials to make the catalyst.
Okay. And that catalyst is a proprietary component, is that correct?
That is correct.
And what about patents? How many patents and kind of what do they cover?
We have a number of patents surrounding the solar receiver technology, which is really some really innovative science that's gone into this. We have some patents on the new design of our solar concentrator, which we've just filed. We've got our cost reduction plan underway right now, where we're going to be able to reduce significantly the cost of the superstructure required for building the solar concentrators. So we've got several patents that have been applied for internationally in many, many countries. We don't have any granted yet, but the reason is we kind of went the slow route in our process to conserve capital, and we did that deliberately just to conserve capital, because as we patent in a lot of countries, the costs become very, very high.
Yeah.
So we do expect to probably start seeing patents granted. I would say no later than next year we'll start seeing actual patents granted in different countries.
Okay. On the rollout internationally, at what point do you plan on hitting that aggressively?
I think once we have Plant 1 operational and are able to use that as a demonstration plant, then we're going to move very aggressively, because we can bring in people from around the world to look at our plant and say, hey, here's what we're doing, here's the results we're getting, you can see it for yourself. And that's, that plant, other than being a plant, is really a very, very significant marketing tool for us, because we can say, hey, here it is on a commercial scale running.
Now, in terms of the components that go into this, sometimes the manufacturing can be more difficult than, you know, the assembly and the actual materials involved. You know, designing it is one thing, but coming up with a manufacturing plant that can crank these things out so many units a day can be a serious challenge. Tell us about your manufacturing process that you anticipate for this once you start trying to go into a higher volume. Are the processes well established, or are you going to have to come up with some engineering specific to your manufacturing needs?
The processes are established in terms of we have developed certain processes for components that we would manufacture, which we would consider the proprietary components or components that have a proprietary manufacturing aspect to them. And those components are small in scale compared to, say, the superstructure, which is large. We would intend to farm out the large superstructure and large component manufacturing to third-party companies that have expertise in manufacturing such items. And there is a concern there in that we have today a seemingly labor shortage. So, you know, that is a bit of a concern. And we may have to do things like import people from other countries, or maybe even do some offshore manufacturing of some of the superstructure components and bring them in, just because of the labor shortage we're facing in North America right now. In terms of building out in-house, we don't have an issue with that. We employ a lot of automation, even in our research, and we'll simply expand that into the manufacturing of our proprietary components. So there's not going to be a huge labor component to it, as much as a manufacturing automation component.
Let's talk for a minute about your array. Could you tell us, I've seen a number of designs from you, and I'm not sure if the one that I saw in Arizona, if that was kind of the one you're sticking with, or if you've fine-tuned that a little bit more. But you're not looking at a really large surface. Apparently, it's the shape. In this picture that we have on our site featuring your technology, there looked like around 24, maybe 30 square mirrors that are mounted on a frame that focus parabolically into a concentrator.
That's right. That's a small-scale system. We're going to be looking at arrays that measure over 40 feet across, but similar in design from general appearance, but there's going to be some innovations because of this. The size of the structures, and the point of focus capability that we have to maintain. So some of the new technology that's going into this new array design will maintain that kind of tight focus without having a super heavy structure. This is part of the new innovation we've got in the array. And I can't talk too much about how we do that until we get clearance from our patent attorneys to do the disclosure on that. But needless to say, as part of our cost reduction plan, we wanted to be able to reduce the cost of the superstructure. And, of course, but when you do that, you lose rigidity, which is a key component. But how do you compensate for that? And we've basically achieved the method to do that, and, which is part of the last patent application we've made.
Okay. Now, in this picture that we have on the smaller array that is maybe 10 feet across and maybe 6 feet or 8 feet high, it's rectangular in shape. And then it's parabolic in shape as well. Are each of those square sections, are they parabolic by themselves, or are they flat?
Our sections are parabolic. And we actually have a process where we actually produce the parabolic reflectors ourselves.
Is that part of a patent process, or?
No, that's part of a trade secret process. One of the problems we looked at in commercializing our technology was if we're deploying in any kind of volume, there's a very limited number of manufacturers in the world that can produce reflective facets in any kind of volume, and we would really rapidly tap that out. So this kind of leads back to one of your previous questions, if there's any bottlenecks, and we identified this bottleneck early on. So what we said is we have to have a process where we can make these things way faster than can be made today in industry. And we actually developed a process to do that that is on the order of, 30 times faster than what's done in industry today on one line, which is really, really novel. And that is a trade secret. So we're not going to even be divulging how that's done. Because it's a process that we do in-house in the manufacturing. So we think the best protection on that is to keep it as a trade secret. But we basically eliminated that potential bottleneck by developing that part of that technology ourselves, which is a process technology.
Very good. Now, you talked earlier about the temperature that this would reach, 6,000 degrees Celsius, 11,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and you said that the process is much more efficient at the higher temperatures. What is the lower end of the threshold? You know, some places get sun continuously for the most part, but others, regions of the world, I mean, you're up there in Canada, and you've got a tighter angle, more interference with the atmosphere. What kind of lower threshold do you have for making this cost-effective?
It's more a factor of sunshine hours per day than anything. An interesting thing we learned when we had our test system in Canada versus having it in Arizona was that we had, I think it was 20% more solar flux here in Canada than we had in Arizona, which really surprised us. Because for that very reason, we're going through more atmosphere. So why are we getting 20% more solar flux up here compared to Arizona? And I can't say with definity what it is, but my theories are we could have the ozone hole up here, which is allowing more UV to go through. Also, there's probably more pollution in Arizona, which is blocking out some of the sunlight. So in terms of having a thicker amount of atmosphere to go through, it seemed to have negligible effect. We couldn't really compare it because, like I said, we had 20% more energy here. We see when we operate this that when we come down to the twilight part of the day, when the sun's going down, you can then start to see a very sharp drop in the energy output where it becomes unoperational. And at that point, the sun is, you know, not far above the horizon. It's probably within half an hour of setting. At that point, then we start seeing the energy drop. So I don't see the issue being how far north we are necessarily or how far south, as much as how many sunshine hours a day do we have. So, you know, for example, and we'd have to, you know, verify this, but, you know, at the North Pole during the summer, you have 6 months of sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
But it operate there, I can't say, because we are going through a thick amount of atmosphere because of the low angle. You know, we're not that far north to make that determination or have tested to verify what would happen. But if it wasn't that much of an attenuation, then it would work, irrespective of the temperature. Because what we're doing, this is something else people ask us: how would this work in a cold climate? And a good analogy is this: if you have a light bulb, a standard incandescent light bulb, and you turn it on, that filament glows at approximately 1700 degrees Celsius in your building. If you take that same light bulb and put it outside on a cold Canadian winter day when it's 40 below degrees Celsius or Fahrenheit, what happens is that light bulb still glows, because that very minor temperature variation of 20 degrees Celsius going from minus 40 to 20 degrees room temperature is minor compared to your operating temperature, in this case, which would be 1700 degrees Fahrenheit for that light bulb filament. So similarly, because we're using concentrated sunlight, the temperature doesn't have much of a bearing on it.
And you're focusing it to a point.
Yes.
So it's not like you have a large surface area to cool off or to heat up.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine that cloud cover would be more of an issue than angle of the sun.
It is. That is your primary issue, is how much cloud cover do you have.
Mm-hmm.
We do need shadow casting sunlight. We can't operate with cloud cover, which would be the case for any concentrating system.
Now, I've not heard that phrase before, shadow casting sunlight. Maybe you could talk about that for a second.
Well, for example, solar cells use amorphous materials or silicon or whatever materials to create electricity from the photons that strike it. And these solar panels are basically flat panels, and they will operate on a cloudy day, of course, with a lot less output than they would with sunlight, because you're still getting a lot of light that's scattered from all directions of the sky due to the clouds. In the case of a concentrator, that doesn't work, because you have to redirect basically a parallel beam of light from the sun to a focus, and you're not getting that with overcast skies. So you don't get a hot spot. You need a direct shadow casting light source to do that. A good example would be to take a magnifying glass and try to ignite a piece of a brown paper on a cloudy day. You're going to have a hard time to do it, where on a sunny day you'll have no problem at all.
What would you see as being the primary obstacle or challenge for you right now?
I think the primary challenge is capitalization. We are building commercial-scale plants, which are really mega projects in scale, and we need millions of dollars to deploy these plants. Going forward from Plant 1, we're going to be able to access financing from debt financiers, banks, and different kinds of, money sources. On Plant 1, it's difficult because we don't have a proven on a large commercial scale. So our biggest obstacle to go forward is the capital to build this first plant.
So you're still pulling together the capital for this plant in that we're talking about in Regina?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Can you tell us how much you're looking for?
We're looking to raise $10 million for this first plant.
That's how much is left, or how much you need total?
That's how much we need total.
And while we're talking about that, I would imagine, let's talk for a second about investment in your company. Are you publicly traded, or how does that work if people want to put money into this?
No, we're not publicly traded. We're a private corporation, and as such, it restricts the capital sources that we can go after. So really at this stage, the people who can invest are either accredited investors, defined as someone having a net worth of $1 million or more, or someone having an annual income of $200,000 a year or more, or if you make an exempt trade. And that varies from state to state and province to province, and it typically means you've got to make a minimum investment somewhere in the range of $100,000 to $150,000, and then it's considered an exempt trade.
Okay. We haven't given your website address out yet. Go ahead and give that to us.
Sure. It is www.shec-labs.com.
And we do have coverage of you also at PezWiki.com, our little synopsis and overview. You are in our top 100 energy technologies listing, and I think you moved up in our list the last time we updated it a few days ago.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
I'm glad to be recognized by you guys.
Now, on your... Let's talk about personnel for a second. When I went down to Phoenix, it seemed like there were quite a few people involved in your project. Has it stayed somewhat the same over time, or are you gradually increasing in the number of people that are involved in this? How's that working?
Because we're going commercial now, we've developed a number of partnerships that allows us to commercialize faster than we otherwise would be able to. And this involves the partnership with Giffords & Jenium, which is a large engineering firm. And they bring a lot of engineering deployment experience to the table. So basically, they're going to be managing the deployment of these stations and doing the supervision of the deployment. In addition to that, we have partnered with a company called Clean 16 that provides the gas cleaning and proportioning technology to remove the contaminants from the landfill. We also have a number of other not as significant partnerships. So through our partnerships, we've, of course, increased our people power significantly to enable us to deploy these large-scale plants, not only this first one, but on a global scale.
Uh-huh. You're talking about the process. Reminds me of a question I wanted to ask earlier. You talked about after you remove the contaminants, you would put it into a proportion of 50-50 CO2 to methane. How do you do that? Is that a fairly straightforward process, or is that a little tricky?
You have to go through a gas separation process, and in regards to doing the methane from carbon dioxide splitting, that's going to be the expertise of our strategic partner. So if I gave a comment on that, I might be wrong, but I'm guessing it could be pressure swing absorption, but then again, I might be wrong. It might be an absorption-based process.
Uh-huh. All right. And that process is crucial to the catalytic ratios required to the incoming gases to the outcoming desired outcome?
Well, I wouldn't say it's crucial, but it's the stoichiometric ratio of the reaction occurring. So if it's off balance, what will happen is you're going to get a partial reaction occurring,
mm-hmm.
which is not going to be detrimental. But I should note, too, that a lot of, for example, landfill biomass sources come close to that 50-50 ratio off the bat. As a matter of fact, the gas analysis off this Regina plant shows us at approximately that ratio right now. So, however, that can vary from plant to plant. You might have plus or minus 10% as an example.
All right. Really quick, we're just about done here. We've got a couple of minutes before we need to wrap this up. We've not talked about the capping process of how the landfill gathers that methane. Maybe you could touch on that for a minute, of what that looks like, what kind of equipment it takes, and how long it takes to set that up.
Well, basically they have a number of wells that they drill into the ground about 20 feet deep. They go down vertically. And the top of the landfill is covered with a membrane or cap soil, which could be a clay soil, basically to prevent the easily leaking of the methane into the atmosphere. So what happens then is you have to apply a vacuum to pull the gases out. And it's a balancing act, because what you have to do here is you have to pull it out as fast as it's being produced. If you put too much draw on the gases, what can happen is you can be pulling air in into the landfill, which is not good, because you could end up with a landfill underground fire.
Uh-huh.
So you have to very carefully balance the amount of draw you're putting on the landfill to its production rate. And you can vary the production rate of the landfill, too, by the amount of moisture that's applied to the landfill. You can accelerate the anaerobic decay by adding moisture.
Wouldn't the air coming into it also affect the anaerobic nature of the decay?
Yes, it would. So it's important that you don't do that. You don't want to bring in air to the system.
So that would require a specialist, somebody who knows how to gauge that.
Well, what happens in the plant that draws off the gas, you basically have a large vacuum pump that's pulling out the gas, and you've got analysis equipment that's reading the gas in real time as it's coming off, and it measures methane, carbon dioxide, and oxygen. So what happens, if it sees an oxygen rise, what will happen is it will reduce the flow rate to prevent oxygen from being drawn into the system.
We've come to the end of our segment here. I appreciate you coming on the show with us, Tom, and talking about your technology whereby you can take the landfill gases and use solar power to convert that into usable hydrogen gas and also commercial-grade CO2. We wish you the best. Their website is Scheck-Labs.com. We've got coverage of them at PezWiki.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.